Hello and welcome to another World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. So September 2018 marks the 80th anniversary of the Munich Agreement, where the British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain flew to Germany to meet Hitler in an attempt to avert war. He famously returned with an agreement which he believed would deliver peace in our time. It got me thinking about Hitler's rise to power. In 1933, he joined the government, one of only three Nazis in it. 5 years later, he is dominating European foreign policy as he pushes forward with his agenda. So in this episode, I thought we'd look at Hitler's rise to power, from the end of the First World War through to him joining the government in 1933. Joining me today is Professor Matthew Stibbe of Sheffield Hallam University. He has written an excellent chapter in the New Oxford Illustrated History of the Third Reich, looking at the rise of National Socialism. But just before we get to that, I could use your help. This podcast is brought to you with the help of patrons of the show, listeners like you who commit to contributing a dollar or two each month. Collected together, these help me put aside the time to make the podcast. If you enjoy the podcast and haven't already done so, go to patreon.com/ww2podcast to see what becoming a patron is all about. And I thank those who already bask in the satisfaction of contributing to the show. On to the main feature, Matthew. Thanks for joining me. I wonder if our starting point should be to look at the National Socialist German Workers' Party, the NSDAP. Where did it come from? Was it spun off from a pre-war party?
It didn't just appear in 1918. There's two answers to your question. Firstly, before the First World War, in the late 19th century, there were various attempts to win over workers towards more conservative and sometimes anti-Semitic policies, and in a negative sense, to win them away from socialism. So, for instance, in Berlin, there was a Christian social movement run by a man called Adolf Stoecker in the 1870s, early 1880s. And he wanted to call it a kind of a workers' party, but a workers' party that was removed from Marxism, from the Social Democrats. So there were some presidents, not very successful ones, obviously, not very successful in electoral terms, at least. And then in the First World War itself, there was a predecessor to the Nazi Party called the Fatherland Party, which was formed in 1917. And it's formed in particular to oppose the so-called Reichstag peace resolution. So in 1917, in July, the centrist parties in the Reichstag passed a resolution calling upon the government to negotiate an end to the war. That was more moderate than the socialists were calling for. The socialists were calling for end the war now and end it through revolution. The centrist parties were saying, we've clearly lost, we can't win the war militarily. And so the best thing for Germany now is to find a way of negotiating a settlement. We have to continue to fight until we've got a settlement. We're not surrendering, but we need to negotiate a compromise peace. The timing of that in July 1917 was to do with the fact that unrestricted submarine warfare was introduced 6 months earlier, and the Admiralty had said, we can force Britain out of the war within 6 months using this weapon, and that didn't happen. So then the Parliament, the centrist parties, we sometimes call them the Weimar parties, because these are the parties that later became the key centrist parties during Weimar. They called upon the government to negotiate a peace. And this was anathema to the military authorities, who felt that it was an admission that the parliamentarians were saying that the army can't win the war. And instead of having a peace resolution, the army or army supporters called for a Hindenburg peace. And originally, this party was going to be called the Hindenburg Party. A Hindenburg peace means a peace imposed upon the enemy through military victory on the battlefield. Hindenburg I think that he was reluctant to endorse it personally with his name, so they came up with a slightly different name called the Fatherland Party. But it was launched on the 2nd of September 1917, on the day of the Battle of Sedan, or the anniversary of the victory over the French in the Franco-Prussian War in 1870. It was launched specifically to back a Hindenburg peace, a peace by military victory, and to be very anti-parliamentarian. Apart from the literal resolution, it was seen as a bid by Parliament to parliamentarize the German Reich. The idea that Parliament can interfere in foreign policy and ask the government to do this was seen as being symbolic of the growing power of Parliament. And this is obviously the more reactionary forces didn't want this. Now, the Fatherland Party tried and failed to appeal to workers as much as to the middle classes. And it had, at best, modest success in doing this. It tried to appeal to workers by saying, if we have a compromise peace, then the German economy will be ruined. Britain will still control the seas. We won't have overcome Britain's domination of the seas, and your wages and your sense of patriotism will be destroyed by that as well. So it wasn't very successful. It was largely a middle class. It was also really quite Prussian. If you think about the idea of celebrating the Battle of Sedan, it's a part of Prussian, but not quite an all-German history. It was run by Wolfgang Kapp, who later tried the putsch against Weimar in 1920, the Kapp putsch, and by Admiral von Tirpitz, the naval leader, who had by that time resigned as Secretary of State in the Reich Naval Office. He resigned in 1916 because of the government's refusal at that stage to implement unrestricted submarine warfare. So he was free, in a sense, to enter politics in that way. It also attracted quite a large number of women, middle-class women largely, because so many young men were in the army. It was quite a rowdy party in the sense that it often attracted left-wing agitators, hecklers. Some of the meetings ended in violence. It didn't get very far in an electoral sense. It wound itself up at the end of 1918. During the actual revolution, some of its members literally went into hiding because they thought that Russian conditions would come, i.e. that they would be shot by the Red Revolutionaries, which didn't quite happen. And most of them, at the end of 1919, they went into a new political party called the DNVP, which is the German National People's Party, which until the late 20s was the main right-wing anti-republican party in Germany, although again with a very Protestant outlook, so it wouldn't have so much chance in southern Bavaria, because obviously that's a very Catholic part of Germany. It was nominally a monarchist party, although it didn't literally support the restoration of Kaiser Wilhelm II. So there were presidents, and they said, we want to win you workers away from Marxism and internationalism towards a patriotic style party. And it did have a Munich branch. And I believe that Anton Drexler and Karl Harrer, who were the original founders of the German Workers' Party, had originally been involved in the Munich branch of this Fatherland Party in 1917.
So was this German Workers' Party, this sort of 1919, 1920, was it a fringe party? Was it very much sort of, we're looking at it now as a big important thing, whereas actually at the time it was almost overlookable. I don't know if that's a word.
Yes, and not known outside Munich. Even before 1923, not really known outside Bavaria very much. And there were much bigger extreme right-wing parties in the north of Germany or all over Germany. The historic ones like the Pan-German League, which was founded in 1890, was much, much bigger. And there were other smaller, but still quite sizable, right-wing anti-Semitic groups across northern Germany in the early 1920s, which had a much bigger national profile than the Nazis would. Hitler only really came to national prominence because of the Beerhof Putsch in 1923, and especially because of the trial in its aftermath that gave him national and, to some extent, international publicity. But before then, it was seen as a Bavarian fringe party. And although the Nazis themselves were not Bavarian separatists, it was a very open question in the early 20s whether Bavaria would really stay part of the German Reich or not. It looked south in some ways. The early Nazi Party had more contacts with extreme anti-Semitic groups in the German-speaking parts of the former Habsburg Empire, in German Austria and in the Sudetenland, than they did in Berlin or in northern Germany. They were South Germans. That whole sort of unofficial South German space looked like it would be a a place for the National Socialists, but they didn't really. It took them a long time to move themselves north. And for instance, they didn't take part in the Kapp Putsch, which is the first attempt, the right wing attempt by Wolfgang Kapp to overthrow the government in Berlin in 1920. They were too small and insignificant to be involved in that plot.
With this early party, was the thing that held them together more than anything else that they were anti-Marxist rather than any sort of any true other policy direction? Would that be
fair? Yes, anti-Marxist, and because there'd been a revolution in Bavaria, and very first of all, there'd been a revolution in November 1918, and then very briefly in April 1919, a red revolution, a brief Soviet republic. There's a lot of anti-Marxism, fear that Marxism would come back. There's a lot of exaggerated fears that after the overthrow of the Munich Soviet in May 1919, that the Marxists were biding their time to come back. And the violence during the Bavarian Soviet, the Reds shot some hostages, but the white violence, the counter-revolutionary violence, was on a much bigger scale. But still, there's this sort of civil war atmosphere in Munich, and a fear that the Reds will somehow come back. It's linked in with a fear of Russia. In Munich, there's quite a lot of anti-Bolshevik exiles from Russia, including Russians, but also so-called Baltic Germans, Germans who had grown up in Tsarist Russia or had lived in Tsarist Russia and had come, because of the revolution and because of the war, had come to Munich. And they had all their bizarre conspiracy theories as well, particularly linking Jews to Marxists. So there's all kinds of small fringe conspiracy groups who didn't really have much idea about political campaigning, but sort of closed groups. They didn't have open meetings particularly. You know, the Thule Society, T-H-U-L-E, was one of these groups. There was a very, very small group, but some of their members were shot as hostages by the Bavarian Marxists, by the Bavarian Soviets, as their regime crumbled. They held a few hostages and they shot them at the last minute. So, yes, Munich was a turbulent place. At this time, it had a red revolution, but the countryside surrounding it was still very conservative. And that's where the Bavarian Soviet was defeated by armed groups that came from the surrounding countryside and sort of conquered the city again.
So when Hitler joins, I mean, there's a story that he joined as a government spy or an agent for the military. Now, there seems to be some doubt upon that. I mean, now, my assumption is that's his story that he spun. If that is a story that he spun, you know, why does he come up with it? Why does, you know, do we know how he got? It struck me as either he joined it because he wanted to be in, or why would someone spin this story that he joined it as an army spy, military spy?
The standard line is that he was sent by the army, of which he was still a member at that time, or albeit about to be demobilized, to spy on something that sounded a bit radical and a bit revolutionary. But it now turns out that he may not have done that at all. I mean, he does seem to have fallen out with his former army boss in the late 20s. I think they fell out politically. His former boss was really a member of the Bavarian People's Party, which is a more moderate right-wing Bavarian party. And he didn't accept National Socialist politics. So they did have this falling out. But remember, the Reichswehr is sort of in dissolution. Part in 1919, and eventually, of course, under the Treaty of Versailles, that the German army is only allowed to have 100,000 men. But before then, there's all these demobilized men who haven't got very much to do, and the army is very worried about, I suppose, about soldiers who haven't got anything to do. They might become undisciplined, and I suppose they invent jobs for them to do, and this is what Captain Meyer did. I think there's still probably half a story in it, that the Bavarian army would have been looking for people who they might eventually formally recruit as political intelligence officers, but they might give them some informal jobs, tasks to do, to see whether they are up for it or not. I suppose Hitler got too involved in this party, didn't he? And Captain Meyer eventually had to come to the conclusion that Hitler was a political rabble-rouser, not a political intelligence officer.
He got in too deep.
He got in a bit too deep. Exactly, yes.
And it's very quickly, he is... You know, he seems to sort of take control relatively fast. In February 1920, he announces the 25-point programme, which is sort of a mix of nationalistic racism, solid socialist ideas. I mean, how much was this was just sort of crowd-pleasing, you know, playing to the audience? Or is it or do you think this was a real piece of conviction politics that we see delivered here?
That's a good question. I think the confusing thing is about the socialism in the title. And whatever else they didn't want to look like international Marxists. They wanted to be they're the enemy, the main enemy. So they want to find a program that attracts workers and wins them away from Marxism. And that means trying to make an appeal and a pitch that suggests that they're going to reward so-called honest labor and make sure that those who do honest, upright Germans who do an honest job will be rewarded in an honest way. And those who have undeserved unearned income, those who've made profits out of the war, and particularly this linked in with the anti-Semitism, the idea that Jewish capital or finance capital, the movement of money around the place, making money out of more money, is dishonest and not solid work. I think that's partly because during the war, there's a lot of feeling that some people have got very rich undeservedly. The war, as it went on, drew a lot of criticism of so-called work-shy people, people who weren't pulling their weight, people who were welfare recipients, people who refused to work, who were sometimes dubbed so-called useless eaters, which is a horrible phrase to use, but became very prevalent during the Nazi time itself. But honest German workers will get an honest reward for their labour. So it's a strange concept, isn't it? It's sort of there's anti-modernist elements in there. The idea that big capital, particularly foreign capital, has got too powerful. Globalisation has got too powerful. It's also linked to the wartime inflation and the fact that money in work seems to have lost its value. You get paid, but it's in paper money that quickly loses its value. Nothing seems solid or grounded anymore. The hyperinflation reached its peak in 1922-23 when things really got out of hand. On top of losing the war, the devaluation of the currency and the fact that in a state of hyperinflation, everything seems to have a monetary value. Everything can be, which changes constantly, it's in constant flux, but everything can be bought and sold. You are how much money you have now in this very moment. How much money do you earn now? Americans are very rich. They've got access to the dollar is now a hard currency and so forth. So I think the idea of appealing to German workers and saying, but we have values over and above that, the value of what you produce, the work, the high quality craftsmanship you have, that should be justly rewarded, not just rewarded in useless paper money. You will be recognised and honoured as workers and properly remunerated and regain that kind of pride in work that appears to have been lost in the wake of the lost war and the inflation crisis. But it is complex and deliberately ambiguous because they've got to appeal, just like any new political party that comes into a situation where there are already established parties, has to try and create a new pitch and to try and reconcile contradictory demands. On the one hand, if you're going to be anti-Marxist, obviously you're going to appeal to the middle classes in one sense, but you want to appeal to workers as well. You're going to have to try and to create a program that can't be met in full because parts of it are diametrically opposed to other parts of it.
Because it struck me as it's a very much of an all things to all men. It's, you know, if you cover up point one, you can have point two and three, and and off you go, and everyone's sort of satisfied.
That's the attempt, isn't it? I mean, it's an attempt to be what's called a catch-all party, and like you say, it's what modern electioneering is all about. Traditionally, I suppose in the 19th century, some of the real diehard conservatives didn't want to get involved in politics. They thought it was beneath them to campaign like that, you know, to campaign for every single vote that's going. But clearly, particularly after 1923, when the Nazi Party makes its decision to try and win power through the ballot box, that's all they've got to do. In some senses, they are a modern political party like any other political party. And not all of their ideas are original. A large number of them are borrowed or stolen from other parties. Calling yourself a workers' party means you're partly borrowing from the Marxist parties by just having the word workers in your title. They certainly like the colour red. And other parts of the pro-family stuff is often borrowed from the Catholic Centre Party. They look at the other parties that are successful at piling up votes. and they borrow bits and pieces from their political platforms. What they were interested in is mobilising large numbers of people, and they had to borrow quite a lot from the left, because I said in the 19th century, the conservative right tended less to want to be involved in that kind of politics. They were behind the left in that sense, whereas Hitler is trying to create, I suppose, the Nazis succeed in the sense they became the first right-wing political party to mobilise large numbers of people. Ordinary people, workers, small businessmen, etc. And in order to do that, they did borrow some of the methods of the left. Mass mobilisation in the 19th century was largely a left-wing pursuit.
I wasn't sure if some of if that that this very early piece of a document was, you know, very much more conviction, and then he softened his tones later on. And then obviously, you know, in that sort of Weimar period.
Or
would he come out gunning for it straight away?
Yeah, I mean, selling this, it becomes more sophisticated as the Nazi Party becomes a national party and a serious competitor in elections. Hitler was stuck very rigidly to that programme and didn't want to revise it in any way. I think that he wasn't the sole author of it. There was Gottfried Feder and one or two others who, Gottfried Feder particularly, put the economic clauses, the economic points in. I think one of the reasons why Hitler stuck to this original programme is he was very romantic and sentimental about the early days of the Nazi Party and just that kind of community of a very small number of people. I mean, I think he was the 55th member, or he had membership number 55, so historians assume that there were, when he joined, there were 55 members, or he was the 55th. So that's very small, but it's enough to know everybody. It's that kind of building outwards, that idea of growing organically from that small community group. When there's 55 members, you can know them all. Even in the Third Reich itself, when many of the senior appointments made both in the party and the regime did not go to so-called Altkämpfer, the oldest party members, Hitler still had those very strong bonds of loyalty with the people who were there at the very, very beginning of the Nazi movement. Often he wanted to go back to the roots of the movement, which is what, you know, the street fighters of that time. So it's not necessarily the text of the programme that's important, but the atmosphere in which it was created. I think that's important. Anyone could go through that programme and say, well, you haven't, you know, in power, you haven't implemented this, or you haven't implemented that, or you haven't done this, or you haven't done that. But I think that was quite the point. The point was, this was a programme which clearly had racism very strongly in it. This is the ethos of the party.
And in this sort of revolutionary zeal, you know, when the Ruhr is occupied in 23 for the first time, isn't it? And this sort of passive resistance in the Ruhr, Hitler's tub-thumping about, you know, marching on Berlin and revolution. I wondered, you know, if he's in, at this point, he's in a very much that provincial bubble, rather than having a national mood for revolution.
Yes, I do think so. I mean, I think that's very interesting, because the Nazi Party was exceptional. Most of the right-wing parties, far-right parties in northern Germany, supported the passive resistance against the French. There were even some far-right groups that had this temporary alliance with the communists against what they called French imperialism. The communists supported the passive resistance because it was a workers' movement and because it was striking against what they called French imperialism. And some of Hitler's rival right-wing parties in northern Germany liked this. They started talking about national Bolshevism, and they would never have dreamt of marching on Berlin. And, you know, Germany had been invaded. You don't overthrow the government, you attack the French. Whereas Hitler's view was probably only really going to have much resonance in Bavaria at this time, which is slightly separate from the rest of Germany, or felt itself that, you know, that the real traitors were in Berlin. And in order to have that view, you have to be not just anti-Marxist, but a little bit anti-Prussian as well, a little bit sort of, you know, you have to see Munich as a centre of the universe rather than Berlin, if that makes sense. I mean, from the point of view of Berlin, whatever your politics, there's a state of emergency in Germany because the French army's invaded the Ruhr and there's a strike going on, and you should be supporting the strike, not undermining the national government that's in power in Berlin. To put hatred of the so-called internal enemy, however broadly defined, above the desire to kick out the external enemy was politically quite risky and quite made the Nazi movement stand out, I think, at that time as well, yes. But the idea that you had to cleanse Germany from within before you could sort out the external borders of Germany did stand out at that time, yes.
And that presumably leads to the beer hall putsch in, it's November, isn't it, in 23.
I mean, that was the ostensible excuse that... In September 1923, the new Stresemann government in Berlin called off passive resistance and suggested that the workers should go back to work so that they could negotiate a deal with the French. They didn't declare the strike a complete failure. They felt that it had forced the French to back down a little bit as well. And they were helped by the fact that Britain and America refused to join in the French Franco-Belgian invasion. But the new incoming Stresemann government in August, September 1923 felt there had to be a negotiated solution. And the only way to start negotiating with the French was to call off passive resistance. After a few months, that did work. It was sort of resolved. The French did withdraw from the Ruhr. The currency was restabilized. But in Bavaria, it's felt that was some kind of betrayal in Berlin, that they called off passive resistance. And that the only way to restore Germany's confidence was to overthrow the government in Berlin and to begin rebuilding Germany spiritually more than anything else from within.
So what were the aims of the putsch, the beer hall putsch as it was?
First of all, to overthrow the government in Bavaria, use Bavaria as a base, Munich as a base, to march on Berlin, a little bit like Mussolini in October 1922 had marched on Rome, to take what was felt, you know, to take Bavarian patriotism and Bavarian concepts of order to Berlin, get rid of what they called the Marxist government there, and from there onwards begin to rebuild Germany. But it's a bit vague, I suppose, what they do once they're in power in Berlin. It was to launch a revolution beginning in Munich and then to march like Mussolini had done on Berlin.
It sounds slightly potty, though, if there weren't necessarily a strong national party to think you can do that.
Yes. It's true, except that they felt that the story that especially the far right, but not just the far right, told about the Russian Revolution is that Lenin only had a few followers and yet managed to seize power in Russia. What you needed, I suppose, was the will to succeed rather than the material foundations to succeed. I mean, if that makes sense. But yes, you're right. It was potty. And I think Hitler subsequently realised that it was potty. What he hoped was that the forces, that the army and significant elements in the army and the police would automatically side with him, and that didn't happen. That was the miscalculation. He thought that his small group would grow massively by the army, significant elements in the Bavarian army and the police taking the side of the putschists, and they didn't do that. You know, there was a shootout in the centre of Munich, and most of the army in Munich and most of the police officers sided with the state and destroyed the putsch.
It's surprising for what is really sort of an uprising that he only gets 5 years in prison. I mean, I would have thought most of the countries for treason, you'd be hung out to dry, but 5 years is not very long at all.
Partly he was put on trial in Bavaria, and there's a very conservative atmosphere in Bavaria after the Soviet Republic, and the judge in the case had very conservative politics, who believed that Hitler had the right motives, in inverted commas, even if he went about doing things the wrong way. I suppose in his mind, he had, as a servant of the law, he had to say nobody's above the law, so there has to be some kind of punishment. But on the other hand, he gives the minimum possible because he believes that he acted out of patriotic motives. The prosecutors asked that not only, I don't know how many years they asked for prison, possibly for a longer sentence, the prosecutors, but what they did ask and didn't get as well was a guarantee that Hitler would be expelled to Austria at the end of his sentence because he's a foreigner. He only became German, I think, in 1931 or 32. He only got German citizenship. He was from, you know, he's from Austria. Most foreigners convicted of treason would be expelled after the end of their sentence, and he wasn't. He was considered to be... Even though he wasn't legally German, the judge considered him to have acted in a German way, in a patriotic way, in some kind of, or his motives were of the Germanic kind rather than the international Marxist kind. And therefore, he was inclined to be lenient in that sense. I think also, as I said, the Bavarians were feeling, Bavaria was feeling like it was a kind of running an alternative Germany to what was happening in Berlin, and that they were the bastions of more conservative values at that time. But it was an extraordinarily light sentence, yes. Certainly much less than communists, left-wing revolutionaries would have got if they were in charge of the same offence.
Well, and it's very much a turning point. It seems to be an epiphany moment for him in many respects. Would that be fair?
The epiphany in the sense that he sees now that he needs to conquer power through the ballot box and cannot launch a coup in the same way that the Bolsheviks had allegedly done in Russia, that it couldn't just be a small group of people who then hope that the army and the police would side with them, that there had to be a substantial popular backing. It had to be a people's movement of some kind, a populist movement of some kind. In that sense, he would have to change tack and think about how to mobilise mass numbers of voters.
And do you think that's come about partly because Germany itself has changed from those turmoil years? We have a relative stability in the Weimar at this point.
We do, by the time Hitler gets out of prison in January 1925, I suppose, yes. He comes out to a situation where Stresemann was no longer chancellor, he was foreign secretary by then, but they've managed to sort out quite quickly Germany's terrible international problems. They've got there's a new government in France, Briand's government, and they've managed to get an agreement about reparations, the Dawes Plan, and an agreement about French withdrawal from the Ruhr, and a move towards reconciliation. And worse still, I suppose, from the Nazis' point of view, not only has that been successful in diplomatic terms, but it's also been quite successful in domestic terms. Stresemann has become, and the government that he's part of, have become quite popular. It looks like, for most Germans, at least outside Bavaria, the whole Ruhr crisis did convince them that there was no alternative but to negotiate with the French, and to accept that Germany lost the First World War, and that they're going to have to come to some kind of deal arrangement with the Allies rather than simply reject the peace settlement and reject the obligation to pay reparations, and that this was the right path to take. And that was combined, I suppose, with the way that the currency was restabilized was very brutal in a way, and there was no parliamentary majority for the way it was restabilized. It had to be pushed through emergency legislation without parliamentary approval. But it meant that people with small savings lost a lot of their money because the way that the new currency was set against the old currency. But for most people, within quite a short period of time, people who are reliant on wages rather than savings, people who, you know, they could see that they were actually earning money again, that actually bought them food and the essentials of life, and they could pay their rent, and they could. So I do think that you know, when he came out of prison, he had to think about how to launch this party and look for those who were discontented with this new situation. There were losers as well as winners from the way that the crisis was resolved. I mean, the whole Ruhr crisis, including the hyperinflation and the launch into emergency government and so forth.
Are these years before we get to the financial crash and crisis at the end of the 20s and into the 30s, are these wilderness years for the party, or is it just the party starting again from an electoral process? Because they don't really burst onto the scene, really, until...
No, Ian Kirsch and others have said, you know, very convincingly, that this is a time where some of the organisational details and structures are created. It's also a time, interestingly, when many of the other rival North German right-wing parties fold. It's a problematic time for all extreme right-wing parties. Extremism is not particularly popular. It's a centrist time. So a lot of them fold, and the Nazi Party, I suppose we can say, was lucky enough to survive this very lean period where others went out of business completely and their members had to go into the Nazi Party. So it's quite good at picking up members from other collapsing fringe parties. And that gave it, to use a military metaphor, I suppose, outposts in northern Germany from previous defunct parties, from those who just couldn't accept Stresemann's compromise with the French, you know, for those who just couldn't see, who wanted a state of emergency to continue. So if you think the state of emergency is very important, because the Nazi platform and all the right-wing platforms were, we're living in a state of emergency. But in the mid-20s, I guess many Germans didn't want to hear that anymore. They wanted to hear that we can put the war behind us, normal times have returned. and it wasn't a very popular message, but it on the fringes it was, and Hitler managed to collect, I suppose, create this organisational structure that spread across Germany, and to a bit more professionalisation of speakers, a bit more policing of the party to weed out people who claim to speak up on the party who are considered to be an embarrassment, I suppose, or not to be following the correct path. As the party grew in membership, and I think it reached 100,000 by 1928, clearly, and that's across Germany a bit. There's a beginnings of a base in Berlin after Goebbels was appointed Gauleiter there, and there's beginnings of a base in Hamburg and other parts of Germany. Clearly, that needs controlling a bit more. Hitler can control a small number of people in Munich, but it needs the policing of the party, removing people who could potentially cause embarrassment to the party. Hitler was banned from speaking himself until 1927-28. I think he was sort of on some kind of parole conditions for the first 2 years after release, and he couldn't speak in public, so other people had to speak for him. And so there was a kind of foundational base. And then looking at those people who really were ignored by Weimar, I think was important. Germany was an urban society. Most of the voters were urban voters. Cheap food was the platform that most centre-ground political parties stood on, which meant importing it from overseas and not, and therefore allowing the farming economy across Germany to continue to decline. Obviously, the farming community wants high food prices and not cheap food. But for most political parties, it would be in the mid-20s, it would be suicide to campaign on a programme of making food more expensive, especially after the inflationary years. But, of course, in the rural areas, this was quite unpopular. And there was the rural communities felt ignored by the mainstream political parties. The DNVP was still the main right-wing party until 1928, until 1930, but it lost votes in the 1928 election. It was seen as not having much, not being able to influence, even when it's in coalition, not really being able to create a proper voice for the rural community. And Nazi agitators in North Germany, that's where they had their first electoral breakthroughs, the opposite end of Germany to Bavaria, in Schleswig-Holstein and in Pomerania in the north, in these rural areas where, as far as the farming community was concerned, they had to pay lots of taxes to pay for the urban welfare state, but they got nothing back in return. And so the Nazis invented this slogan of blood and soil, the idea that the peasants are the purest Germans, and they're going to be the backbone of Germany's spiritual recovery from this terrible descent that they've had since 1918. Of course, in reality, when the Nazis did come to power in the 30s, they didn't put very much money into farming either. They put all their money into industry because they wanted to build up armaments, and the farmers didn't get investment or much attention by the Nazis either. But in the late 20s and early 30s, that's where they were getting their attention from. And probably what they noticed is that it was a two-stage process of how they stole votes in the rural north from the DNVP. The first stage of that process was that the formation of splinter parties that claimed the DNVP was a national party that had to have a national program, I suppose. But there was some sort of, in rural areas, there were sort of splinter parties formed that simply were low taxes for farmers. That's their program. They win votes locally. They are protest votes, protest party. They don't not think they're going to win an election, but they're going to send an MP for that particular area who's going to represent that constituency that feels left behind. And I suppose there are left behind areas, aren't there? I mean, we see that contemporary Britain today as well. You know, the areas that seem to be ignored by the metropolis. But of course, they do. In 1928, there are a growth of these splinter parties, but they also can't really achieve anything apart from standing up and making a lot of noise. And then by 1930, the Nazis have managed to collect all these different grievances and to soak up votes from the splinter parties as well.
So if we have, sort of, in prosperous times, more prosperous times, sort of a centrist government, why do we get in 25 Hindenburg, you know, the World War One general, elected as president? It's a strange contradiction.
It is a strange contradiction.
He's surely, if I say old world, you appreciate. I mean, he's harking back to something that now has passed.
Yes.
Or is that squaring the circle by having, you know, keeping some of these more reactionary elements within Germany happy?
He had to fight two elections, and they're in totally different contexts. But the first one was quite a surprise. It's surprising in the sense that he won quite a lot of votes from conservative Catholic voters, even though he's quite clearly a Protestant, and in a very traditional sense. It was, to some extent, a revolt from the provinces and the rural areas against the urban. Again, I can think of obvious parallels with today, where people's votes in parliamentary elections are very different to how they would vote in a presidential election, where the president was voted directly as he or she is in France today. So it's a different kind of election. Hindenburg didn't even stand in the first round in 1925, and he was sort of suddenly discovered by all the anti-republican forces, or suddenly got together and all agreed that they would withdraw. They had various right-wing candidates, and they all withdrew in Hindenburg's favour, and he managed to defeat the Republican candidate. Hindenburg was the right-wing candidate in 1925, whereas, bizarrely, in 1932, he was a centrist candidate against Hitler, and won with completely different constituencies. But yes, that does spike the kind of trend towards centrism and towards conservative Germans were voting with their heart when they voted for Hindenburg. In many ways, they're voting for nostalgia and tradition, whereas Stresemann very much presented himself as a Republican of the head. He was, Stresemann in his youth was, of course, a monarchist and in many ways a German nationalist, but he'd become rationally a Republican of the head. He'd come to the conclusion by the mid-1920s that the only realistic politics were Republican politics, and the only realistic foreign policy course was to come to terms with the Allies. And the only ally worth coming to terms with is France, because France won't do it. France is the hardest nut to crack in that respect. The president they voted for in 1925 was, given the state of emergency had passed, was very much a symbolic head of state rather than representing a government. Whereas in 1932, there had already been 2 years of presidential rule in effect.
I was going to come to that for the idea of presidential rule, because when we get the financial crisis, the worldwide financial crisis at the end of the 20s, the start of the 30s, and I think it sort of peaks in 32 or something like that, doesn't it? You get governmental gridlock where coalitions can't make a decision, and essentially the fallback, I'm correct, is saying for government work that needs to commence is the president has to basically push it through and legislate it. Now, I wondered, obviously Hindenburg had done this during the First War. He's used to making great decisions on questions of the state. But I wondered, did this prepare mentally Germany for an authoritarian government? Because before Hitler comes to power, essentially they've kind of had something along those lines with Hindenburg, or have I branched at the wrong tree?
I don't think that's quite right, especially because in the first few years of being president, he had to accept parliamentary majorities and parliamentary rule and didn't do much to block that. So in 1928, before the Great Crash, there was an election, and particularly the SPD, the moderate left party, gained in support quite considerably. And he appointed a coalition led by the SPD. So I think he was more seen as a kind of check on parliamentary democracy, a balance to parliamentary democracy rather than an authoritarian alternative to it, a way of balancing it out rather than a way of balancing out absolute parliamentary rule rather than replacing it or standing over it.
But that is sort of what he does by the early 30s, isn't it?
By the early 30s, he is looking like somebody who's virtually replaced parliamentary government. Yeah, he doesn't quite know what with, but yes, that's right. So mainly in a negative sense, that Parliament had come into disrepute because it couldn't. There was no working majority, and it couldn't come up with a policy that would command a consensus in the country. I mean, the reason why the coalition, the centrist coalition, broke down in 1930 was because the state unemployment insurance scheme that they'd set up to cater for short-term bouts of unemployment for individuals who might be unemployed for six months or between jobs. It went bust in 1930. There are so many claims on it. Either the government had to put more money into that fund, or it had to cut the rate of benefit. And the Social Democrats didn't want to cut the rate of unemployment benefit. And because the other coalition partners wouldn't agree to put more money into the fund, the Social Democrat Chancellor, Hermann Müller, asked Hindenburg, will you give me emergency powers to pass my budget? And Hindenburg said no. Then he appointed a new, more right-wing chancellor without a majority and gave him, Heinrich Brüning, he gave him the right to pass an emergency budget without parliamentary approval, which did introduce the cuts. And of course, there was unemployment in the mid-1920s, but people were short-term out of work, and the insurance fund was intended to just bridge the gap between being in one job and being in another. It's a bit like national insurance in the UK. You had to have been in work for a bit, and you pay your money in, and then you get your unemployment benefit back. But by 1932, there are people who have been out of work for 2 years, and they're school leavers who've never had a job, are out of work, and they're not insured. It's a huge... it's a social breakdown, really. It's a and the Heinrich Brüning government was very, very unpopular, and its cuts were very unpopular, but they were being passed by presidential decree, and that brought Parliament in disrepute because it didn't have an alternative towards it. Now, the SPD, which is the main Republican Party, wasn't in government with Brüning. Brüning's was a minority government, but it had to tolerate Brüning. So as well as some of Brüning's legislation, when it was really not going to get a parliamentary majority, was passed by Hindenburg through emergency decree. But some of it, the SPD simply tolerated, didn't oppose, because it feared another election. Although they're not influencing the policy, the main opposition party seems to not be opposing it either. And so that allows the Nazi Party to pose as the real alternative.
And that wins them in 37% of the vote. That is still not necessarily, you know, that big a real alternative. I mean, if we look at the percentage of the vote, so they've got 31%. Who's got the rest of the vote? Are they just a minor block? Is it that the left-wing communists, all right, there might not be one party, but do they poll 30, 40% of the vote?
No. In 1930 was the first year that the Nazis had their electoral breakthrough, and they came second. The Social Democrats were still ahead of them in 1930. After that, all the polls were suggesting that the SPD was going to lose more votes if there was another election. And also the SPD was very split over whether to tolerate Brüning or not. So they were in a bit of a crisis point. In July 1932 elections, when the Nazis came top with 37%, I believe that the communists got 14%, so that the two anti-system parties had a negative majority between them. I stress negative because there's no way they're going to come together to form a coalition government. But they could block everything. And that really did bring Parliament into disrepute. I mean, apart from anything else, Parliament hardly met. So if you think about from today's point of politics as well, all these deputies, MPs are being paid salaries, but the press will tell you that they only attended 13 days in 1932. So what they're drawing this, you can see how people might have felt. They're drawing a salary when there's 6 million people unemployed for this. And Parliament's in disrepute for that reason as well. They're not doing anything. Politics is not taking place in Parliament. It's taking place in the streets, really, on Saturdays when the Nazis and communists come together to fight it out. Now, that meant that it was very difficult to form any kind of government. And what West Germany did after the Second World War is create a constitution that really, really prevented the notion of negative majorities. So that... in Germany today, under the Constitution of 1949, governments can only be removed by constructive votes of no confidence. That means that if Angela Merkel was to be overthrown today in Parliament by parliamentary vote, those who bought in this parliamentary vote would have to name an alternative. If they haven't got an alternative, then she stays by default. It's called a chancellor democracy in the sense that the chancellor really, really is very powerful in Germany. He or she today can only be overthrown by what's called a constructive vote of no confidence, where there's actually an alternative government being proposed, which meant that. But if you imagine in 1932, the communists and Nazis can just oppose everything And there's no constructive, there's nothing constructive. They can prevent government, parliamentary government, from taking place.
So presumably, when they get to the elections in November, they're all expecting an increase in their voter share, and actually they poll less.
Yes, psychologically that's very significant, because the Nazis, remember, they call themselves a movement as well as a political party, and the movement they want to go in is forwards all the time. The problem with a party like Nazism, it relies very heavily on charismatic authority. It's a new party which really puts its leaders as it has to have constant successes. For a party that relies largely on charisma, setbacks are very dangerous. Whereas for a bureaucratic party like a socialist party, it can lose an election, it can lose a leader, but because it's got a kind of bureaucratic structure behind it, it can survive setbacks. Whereas for the Nazi party, setbacks are very, very dangerous, because it can come and go very quickly. Again, we can think of more modern examples of parties that rise and then fall, disappear. They've had some magic and then they've lost it again. And that was very psychologically important. You have to remember as well that between July and November 1932, I suppose there's early signs of economic recovery. But also, I think all the parties were simply exhausted. The 1932 was the year of so many different elections in Germany, and this is the last one. But they'd fought two rounds of presidential election. They'd fought two Reichstag elections in July and then in November, and then various state elections. They're running out of money. They're running out of energy. Running out of momentum, I suppose, is what we'd say. And factions were beginning to form in the Nazi Party as well, wondering whether Hitler was pursuing the right strategy. What's the point in piling up all these votes if you don't actually get power? The voters, the people who vote for the Nazis, want something to happen, and yet nothing's happening. Hitler turned down the offer in August 1932 to become deputy chancellor. And there were voices in the Nazi Party saying maybe that was a mistake, and maybe that's wrong. Maybe that's maybe we need a new leader or a different strategy, maybe we do need to enter coalition government with one other right wing parties. Maybe the absolutist position of holding out for the top job or demanding the top job was the wrong strategy. So holding it all together in that situation, where a particular momentum is seen to slip a little way out of the hand, is very difficult.
Looking back, you ask people now and they'll go, oh, he swept to power. And there is an idea of this movement, that phraseology that gets used. And it's not. Hindenburg asks Hitler to become chancellor, yet it's only, was it three other, or is it three party members, including him, are in the government? So why does Hindenburg turn to Hitler? Are they politically allied in any way in their beliefs, not necessarily personally?
Well, a year before that, in May, April 1932, they were clearly political opponents, because they were rival candidates in the presidential election. And Hindenburg, ironically, and perhaps not to his own pleasure, was almost standing as a Republican candidate against the extreme right-winger Adolf Hitler. There was a communist candidate as well, Ernst Thälmann, who won about 12% and then 10% in the second round. Hindenburg won, and he won it only in the second round. In order to win in the first round, he had to get 50%, and he just missed that, which probably upset him in the first instance. But secondly, he won the presidency the second time round on a completely different set of votes, really, because the moderate socialist and the Catholic Centre Party told their members to vote for Hindenburg, to keep Hitler out. He's now dependent on voters whose political values he doesn't really share. He's almost against his will been kind of cast as the Republican Party's candidate or masthead or whatever it might be. He doesn't like that. So he, between then and in the next 10, 12 months, he is looking for a realignment of right-wing parties and to shift politics in a right-wing direction. That doesn't mean, in the first instance, handing power wholly to Hitler or appointing a Nazi government. He's got all kinds of prejudices against the Nazi movement, particularly Hitler's Austrian lower middle class lance corporal background compared to Hindenburg, the supreme commander, Protestant aristocratic. I mean, you know, the way they spoke, the language, you know, their accents are completely different. The parts of Germany they come from are completely different. The milieus they've moved in are completely different. But Hindenburg is an old man. He's worried about his legacy and where he's going to leave Germany. And he wants to find some way of... He doesn't want to leave a Germany that's ruled by socialists and Catholics, nor does he particularly want to leave a Germany, I guess, that's ruled by rabble-rousing anti-Semites like Hitler. But he wants to block them in to a new form of right-wing coalition. At the same time, Hindenburg is advised by various people, particularly by the army. Now, the army see a chance. Internationally, they see a chance to overthrow the disarmament clauses of the Treaty of Versailles, because the Great Depression has weakened the Western powers' alliance with each other, America becoming more isolationist, I suppose, 3 million unemployed in Britain, and then there's this World Disarmament Conference where it looks more and more like French intransigence, the French refusing to disarm, and the Britain and America really looking like they want to withdraw from world politics, especially America, means that the Germans are going to win the right, in inverted commas, to rearm. And that's what the army wants, be allowed to rearm. And they want a government that's going to do that. They want a government that's got clever diplomats who can create the right international atmosphere to allow that to happen, but also a government that's going to cut money on everything else, so they can spend more money on armaments. They see this chance. You know, Hitler is potentially a little bit of a liability to the army for all kinds of reasons. Firstly, because Ernst Röhm, the SA leader, appeared to want to merge his SA, his paramilitary group, with the army, which professional soldiers were very much against. But also because a real rabble-rousing politician who starts immediately declaring internationally he's going to rearm might provoke a preemptive strike by France and Poland. And of course, the German army knows that an immediate there's nothing they could do if France and France has got form, you know, 1923, walking into the Ruhr. The professional soldiers that run the army know what they would do if they were in charge of the French army and Germany suddenly said they were going to rearm. We'd walk straight into the Rhineland, and that would lead to the overthrow of a government in Berlin, or it would certainly strengthen France's position. So they need somebody who's got enough political clout to realise that the background to rearmament's got to be prepared. And I guess that's one of the reasons why there's only three Nazis in the original cabinet for the international position, because Hitler has written that book Mein Kampf, in which he talks about Lebensraum and all these what appears to be incredible ideas, especially if you've got an army with 100,000 men. The realistic soldiers know it's going to take at least 10 years, perhaps 20, before they've got a decent...
You have to have your building blocks and build upon them.
Yes. Well, they're starting from a very low point, and they know...
Yes, indeed.
They know all about preemptive, you know, the strategy of the preemptive strike. Hindenburg, before he appointed Hitler, he appointed Blomberg as the defence minister, or the Reichswehr minister. So he had somebody in the cabinet for the army, whose job it really was to make sure that the army wasn't politicised, that there's no merger with the SA, and that there was somebody who had a direct line to Hindenburg from the defence ministry without going through Hitler. So you've almost got there's a special cabinet minister with a direct line to Hindenburg, which is and Hindenburg really wanted to keep the army out of politics. He didn't want the army to become Nazified. He thought that would be disastrous. And in many ways, that didn't happen, did it? The SA wasn't merged with the army. The army, after Hindenburg's death, the army did swear an oath of loyalty to Hitler and personally, but not to the Nazi party. In some ways, it pertained to professional independence. In some ways, I mean, I'm sure there's a big debate to be had about that.
Integrity might be a better way of putting it rather than independence.
Yes, professional ethos. I think it's kind of the career soldiers could still say to themselves, we're not SA street fighters, we're professional soldiers. Our aim is to rearm Germany, just like Hitler's is, but we need to do it professionally and carefully and sensibly.
It's amazing, with just three members of the cabinet, it's just 18 months before they effectively, I don't know if seize power is the...
Well, so the word seizure of power is controversial. I mean, the Nazis themselves, like, especially Goebbels...
I guess it's better way to say it's 18 months before he's president.
But he didn't become president. He became Führer.
Ah.
The office of president disappeared with Hindenburg. Under, and this is technical stuff, I suppose, in a way, but the Weimar Constitution was never abolished formally. Clearly, it was suspended. In order to be president, you have to be elected. And Hitler didn't call a presidential election or be elected. He called himself Führer after Hindenburg's death, which is a very vague term. Führer of what? It's not specified what he's leader of. He's leader of, well, he was already leader of the Nazi Party, but he now claims clearly in many ways to be leader of the army, leader of the state, leader. But it's not actually spelt out, deliberately left quite vague. So it's the position of Führer is outside the Constitution.
I hadn't quite clocked that.
It doesn't exist in a legal sense. It doesn't exist. But then Hitler himself operated outside the law.
It's funny how there's a sort of a nod to the law by circumventing it, if that makes sense. You don't break it if you circumvent it.
Yes, and that's very important for Hitler's constituency. On the one hand, there's the radical Nazis who Hitler needs to convince, once he's in power, that he's willing to go beyond the law because they're in power now and they can do what, you know, the law cannot be a barrier to achieving the radical aims of the Nazi Party. That's what he has to do in order to rekindle his charismatic relationship with the Nazi Party. So every year he has to go to the Nuremberg Party rally and convince the party that he's still the old Hitler and he hasn't sold out and that he doesn't care about the law. The law's not going to stop him. But on the other hand, for the rest of the year, and mindful of his constituency, he has to sort of create a parallel universe. There's two universes, one in which Germany is still a law and order state and criminals are punished if they steal things and if they there's laws and rules and a court. And then there's this parallel universe where he lives as Führer, where there's something higher than the law, which is the, in his racial view, the existential struggle for against inferior races. And that will justify going beyond the law.
I have one last question. You know, how did the international community view Hitler being made chancellor? When was it headline news or was it just another government in a turbulent Germany?
It was certainly headline news, but it was the fifth or sixth government since 1930. So whether it would survive or not was a question mark. Like you say, there was only three Nazi members, but it was a nine-member cabinet, or maybe 11, but several of the other ministers had served in the previous government. So there was an attempt to create continuities. To some extent, Hitler was treated as a clown, somebody who's all rhetoric and doesn't really mean what he says. Also somebody who is weakened by having lost votes at the previous election, sort of contained in the sense that he's no longer on top of his game, really. He's being contained and boxed in. Seen from an Anglo-American point of view, which is that the whole of Europe is a mess at that time, and that, you know, especially the isolationist lobbies in those countries, it's not worth us spending a lot of money trying to uphold the Treaty of Versailles. Or, you know, Hitler's just one of many dictators by then in Central Europe. So that, for instance, Engelbert Dollfuss in Austria, just a few weeks later, suspended the Austrian parliament and took emergency powers. And Poland was already a dictatorship, and several other countries were as well. So there's a trend towards away from parliamentary democracy. I suppose it does surprise us in retrospect how little notice people took of the dangers that Hitler might be really serious about what his program was, or how quickly Germany might be able to rearm. But I guess people were reassured by the respectability that there's still quite a lot of fonds, you know, aristocrats in the cabinet. I suppose particularly the international roles were held by non-Nazis. So the defense and foreign ministries were non-Nazis. It was the interior ministries that were taken over by Nazis. So, of course, if you're a human rights activist, you'd be quite concerned about the abuses and the setting of the concentration camps and so forth that were involved. But externally, there seemed to be a bit of continuity. And I suppose that was important as well in terms of reassuring. America particularly, I suppose Britain was also beginning to be concerned about Japan and the Japanese invasion of Manchuria in 1931. So again, you know, I think they've got half an eye on that as well, I guess, and kind of it's just one among many potential dangers, but I don't think it's seen as a particular danger or turning point.
With Hitler joining the government, I think that's perhaps the place to leave it for now. Matthew, thank you for that. It was great. If you're interested in reading more from Matthew, you can find him in the Oxford Illustrated History of the Third Reich. It's a great book with chapters on Nazi architecture, the economy, the Holocaust, the home front, amongst other things. I'll put a link on the website. So that's it for now. If you're interested in becoming a patron, you can find out more at patreon.com/WW2podcast. And don't forget, you can find me on Facebook. I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.